So this is October 31st, 2008, and it's a PASFRT teleconference on PASFRT Lecture 201, Demagnetizing Negative Force Fields. And where I thought I would start is what we were chatting about a bit before, and that is that sometimes the lectures can seem deceptively simple. Sometimes, logically, they're so clear that you wonder, but where's the work? You know, now what do I do? One of the things that I have found in the PASFRT lectures is that there is an extraordinary shift in paradigm in how the lectures present reality. So the guide presents reality as being larger than human comprehension. So we have part of the story, we have mirrors to the story, we have allegory, we have as in heaven so below, as below so above. So we have clues and hints, but to some extent what the guide is saying is that we may do the equivalent of only seeing in black and white when the reality is color. So we see extraordinary shades of black and of gray. But in the spirit world, there's such an exponential increase in reality, in dimension, in depth, that we need to take our reality with a grain of salt. We need to take our reality lightly and not presume that it is everything. But there's a place where human beings do presume that what they see and hear is everything. Okay? So, for instance, the guide talks about, we talked a while back about dreams, imagination, and the guide says that in the spirit world there are a multitude of dimensions. Let's pick a figure of 20 just for the sake of argument. Let's say in the spirit world there are 20 different dimensions, whereas here there are four, maybe five dimensions that we can work within. If we go into spirit in our imagination or our dreams, or if we are able to contact spirit, when we try to bring that information back, it's in effect we have to translate from a 20-dimensional world back into a 5-dimensional world. And in that translation, round pegs may have to fit into square holes. That it's not easy to describe the reality of spirit in the five-dimensional world that human beings live in. So, for instance, in this lecture, Demagnetizing Negative Force Fields, when it was given 40-odd years ago, society in general wasn't as comfortable with the idea of energy. The New Age was still working out the kinks in its communication and its methods and its technologies. And so the idea that there were force fields of energy, the idea that human beings held an auric field, an energetic auric field, the idea that we interact with each other by doing, and I say this lightly because, of course, I don't know what it looks like, but the idea that we communicate with each other by throwing bolts of energy back and forth between each other, or bioplasmic streamers, the idea that when I think of somebody I love, I am actually in contact with them in the spirit realm, even though I'm here and they're still in the city that they're in. These ideas were fairly novel or new back 40 years ago. And now it's easier to accept them. They've been talked about. They've had so many disciplines talk about it. And you get so many examples that it seems more reasonable than one or two people saying these things that didn't seem to square with our reality. So in the demagnetizing negative force fields, the paradigm that I'm getting to is that the guide says that, and this is repeated many, many times, every thought creates a world. Again, imagine that. Every thought, every feeling creates a world. Now, in my mind, I see this magic bubble-blowing machine where every thought and every feeling I have creates a little bubble that floats away, and it's a world. And I just see this as being almost a comedy routine of my creating worlds upon worlds upon worlds, day in and day out, endlessly. And if I'm doing that, and you're doing that, and he's doing that, good grief, how do you have room to work? And yet the guide indicates that there is no lack of space in spirit, that we never get crowded. He doesn't seem to think that we have to slow down. But if every thought and feeling creates a world that in the spirit world you can see and touch and feel and experience, that what this lecture is about is that when we generate negativity, okay, we are generating a force field of negativity. Okay, so however you imagine that to be, whether you're covered with frothy bubbles full of negativity, whether you look like Charles Schulz's cartoon character of Pigpen and you're carrying lice and debris around with you, however you imagine a negative force field, like you're a magnet and you've got a whole bunch of iron filings sticking out like crazy hair from you, that we magnetize negativity to us. And it creates a vortex, a force field, that will in turn generate or attract negative force fields in others. Again, if I simply say that, somebody might say, okay, I'll buy that, and, okay? But it is important for us to get this on a very personal and intimate level. And on a very personal, intimate level, what this looks like, and I'm going to joke about this because it's easier, is I remember when I was a child and I was grumpy, my mother would tease me and call me Little Chief Thundercloud. And if you have that kind of grumpy, miserable persona and you're stomping around, what this lecture basically says is that like attracts like. And instead of inspiring the good witch Glenda to come cheer you up, what you'll inspire is another grumpy person to join forces with you. Because the other grumpy person tends to like the fact that you make them feel normal. And now the two of you can grump around together and feel like you're having companionship. So instead of feeling negative, you can actually feel some companionship in the being grumpy and negative. So this is the kind of force field we're talking about. Another joking way to try to describe it, it's as if we all have little radio towers coming out of our head and we're beaming things out. And if you beam positive, you attract and generate positive. But if you beam negative, you'll beam and attract negative. So you're basically energetically saying that you enjoy and wish to participate in negative activities. And so the opportunity to participate in negativity will come to you. So what the guide is saying in this lecture is that if you are in a space where a lot of negativity is occurring to you, that one way to work on this is to look at how you're generating a negative force field. And then to look at how you can stop that, not abruptly, not artificially, but to find the place in you that is sending out the negative force field and making the adjustment of attitude inside yourself so that you are not sending out this negativity and creating this force field. Then if you choose, or the next step might be, to send out a positive force field. But this is not a flipping the switch kind of thing. It is a way of looking inside at your inner attitudes where you are generating this, rather than this happening to you. So the quotes from the lecture, the specific quotes are, every conceivable attitude or concept about life creates such a force field. and the force field of a specific attitude to life is also ruled by laws of attraction, like attracting like. So when I was talking before about as in heaven, so below, and back and forth, what the guide presents in many other places in the lectures is that the laws of physics, the law of gravity, all the laws of nature that we deal with on this planet, the laws of mathematics, all these sciences that we work with, are in effect a version of spiritual law, that the same thing exists in spiritual law on a much broader, much more extensive level. So that you can take Newtonian physics and Newtonian physics of gravity, attraction, inertia, momentum, all these terms is reflected in spiritual law as well. Spiritual law being larger and more expansive than human science. But we shouldn't discard human science. We should perhaps step into it and see a larger picture or see it from a larger perspective. So, sorry, just trying to get my head straight on the next point. I kind of lined this up in what I thought was a logical sequence of information, but I don't know whether it is or not.
It sounds like that brings into play the observer self.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So, in the place where we're asking you to look at your own involvement in something, what part of you is going to do that? So that's what the observer self can be set up to do, that you can find a part of you, and this is not like one mask or another mask. This is not fragments or pie-shaped segments of consciousness. I think that the observer self is a way of anthropomorphizing or using words to describe a part of you. It is capable of being objective, even under strenuous circumstances. So, for instance, people who are trained to be emergency medical personnel, they're not inhuman. They care about blood, they care about pain, they care about urgency, but they've been trained to go through a certain protocol. And there's a part of them that is holding the need to be scientific and careful about what they do because that's the best way to deal with an emergency. And yet the part of them that wants to respond to a human being is so active. And some people can't do that.
Right.
But that would be an example of a profession where the ability to train the objective observer allows you to do something that civilians can't do. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a way of looking at your observer self, that when you find yourself in an emergency, the observer self just stands by and says, let me see, what would be good to do under these circumstances? What is appropriate considering our value system? What is our priority? So a lot of professions use that ability to be objective in the profession itself. So yes, in this work, we need to do the same thing. We need to train part of us to be objective, part of us to be able to stand back out of the emergency and not be overwhelmed by what's going on, but not to be insensitive to what's going on, to not interfere with what needs to be done, but to assist us in keeping our reason, not being rational, but keeping our reason and our reason options open, keeping our emotion options open, and continuing to scan to see if we're taking advantage of everything at hand. So you can think of your objective observer as being like a paramedic or a doctor or an emergency person who will hold that space for you and help you find priorities. So in the paradigm shift, the other thing that it's important to consider, besides the fact that the spirit world might have more dimensions than we do, is that the story as we see it may not be played out in the time period that we have determined is appropriate. I'm being very careful with my words here, because what I'm trying to say is if we think that cause and effect ought to happen within a one-month period of time, that's our thinking process, that's our intellect, that's our, you know, that's just us and our stuff and our beliefs and our fears. When the actual spiritual beginning, middle, and end of this story could extend over a decade. And what we're seeing is a dramatic point in the story. So it's like you're watching, there's a movie, and you're seeing one scene. And in the one scene, you're not getting the full history of how somebody got here, how you got there. And you're not seeing the full panorama of what's going to happen afterwards. You're seeing the one clip.
Now, is that all? I have a question. I'm sorry. Is that all we are capable of seeing?
No, I don't believe so. Personally, I think that we can widen our vision. What I'm suggesting is that people aren't used to doing that. That there's a habit. I'm suggesting that people think that cause and effect should show up sooner than that cause and effect should show up, and the should is based on their needs. Okay?
So how do you separate from that?
Well, by, number one, challenging your own beliefs. Okay, this is where the objective observer can come in.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think that somebody should get their comeuppance. The word that was used in my family, comeuppance.
Yeah.
You will get your comeuppance one day. It's like seeing somebody rob a bank and go to trial and then get off scot-free. Let's just use that as a primitive, cliched example. Okay. People believe that crime should be punished. People believe that guilty people should do whatever they have to do, whether that's go to jail or pay the victim or do whatever it takes. And if we see somebody get off, if we see somebody where they don't get caught or the trial has a mistake in it and they're let free, it can look like there was no link between cause and effect, that somebody committed a crime but did not receive punishment for it. Okay? But in the spirit world, no crime goes unpunished and no good deed goes unrewarded. So in the spirit world, this bad karma that this person created is just sitting out there waiting for them. And it could come to pass, it could resolve in 5, 10, 15, 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
It could also resolve in another lifetime. And that's where, what can we do with that information? So in other words, if we are living today remnants of things we did from another lifetime, and we're not going to complete it in this cycle, and we're going to complete it in another lifetime, how in heaven's name, as an individual human being, are you going to put this story together?
That would be my exact question.
Okay. What the guide says is that there is these soul movements that I talked about before, dreams, intuition, eros, thoughts, mm-hmm. and feelings. These can be guidelines to helping you complete the task that you came here to do, which may only be one segment of a larger story. You're really only here for the one segment, okay? You don't need to know in your conscious mind the entire story. But you can key into that segment and do it so well that you really do have a sense that you're on the right track and you're doing the right thing. And what I'm saying is there is no way to know the absolute truth of the arc of your story. And even if you don't believe in reincarnation, most people believe that there is a spiritual life before a baby is born, and that there is a spiritual life of some kind after death.
Mm-hmm.
So whether or not that manifests in human form, it may manifest in other ways, but the arc may still begin before birth and end after death. So what I'm saying is that you can only deal with the pieces you can access. What the guide is saying is that you may have been prevented from accessing some of the pieces for a reason. Okay? So in other words, if you came here to learn about integrity and you have lost your integrity before, you have a feeling of having lost integrity before. So it gives you more impetus to develop integrity. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to know the precise events of the previous loss of integrity.
Mm-hmm.
But that feeling, that urge, that eros, that need to move on areas of integrity, that will enable you to do in this lifetime what you've come here to do. Now, some people are given sight and psychic vision. The guide simply says it isn't necessary. That highly developed spirits may be able to pray and get guidance and do things that the majority of us cannot. But that just accelerates their ability to accomplish their task. It doesn't, the fact that we don't have a fortune teller telling us every day what, you know, past, present, and future, where we've been and where we're going, doesn't mean we can't complete our task. Does that make sense? Does that answer your question in any way?
Yeah, I'm yes, it does, and I'm trying to tie it in to how you originally started your discussion in Like Attract Like. So, I'm trying to tie those two together.
Okay. So in Like Attracts Like, you have come in with an energy. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And in the lectures, because the guide teaches that reincarnation is what happens, I teach pathwork, so I accept that, that in the setting up of this lifetime, you have brought in certain energies with you. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Those energies were set up to attract other events and other relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So because you have an energy of seeking integrity, if you are resistant to that, you will attract the energy of other people resisting integrity.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are trying to move through that blockage and move into integrity, you will tend to attract people who are doing the same thing. Or perhaps who've even gotten there and who recognize your efforts. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So again, you don't have to know the precise details of how you got here and why this is your specific task. But you can take the evidence of what is happening in your life as evidence of where you might be energetically. Now that comes in at the end of this lecture a little bit. Let me find it. I'm going to bookmark that. Okay, but I think I need to go through cause and effect first, or this won't make any sense.
Hmm.
So I'm making a note to come back to that. But let me see if adding cause and effect will help here. So on the theme of demagnetizing negative force fields, okay, what happens is that the reason we find ourselves in a morass is because cause and effect have become separated. Now, there's a whole beautiful lecture on cause and effect. It's called Commitment Cause and Effect, and it's Patrick's Guide Lecture 196.
Mm-hmm.
And it says the same thing, that when cause and effect are separated, there can be confusion. You can do the right thing, but you don't see a positive result from that. And that makes you think that good deeds aren't rewarded. You can do a negative thing and not get caught, and think you've got away with it when the effect is going to come around and nip you about 20 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is that in the first case, when you're doing positive energy, if you're putting out positive deeds, let's pick something. Let's say you're doing volunteer work for charity, and you're putting a large amount of effort in, and you really are genuine, it's coming from your heart, you don't expect reimbursement, you do not expect immediate gratification. You're looking to do it from the sake of giving. But after 20 years of giving, what if you feel that you have not attracted reward? And while that may not have been your primary goal, in the back of your mind, it was there. And you wonder, how can somebody give to charity? How can somebody work 20 hours a week for charity and have negative things happen to them? What this lecture is about is using the observer self and going deeper and taking a look at where this could be actually valid, that despite the 20 years of giving service, there was still some negativity going on that thought it could get away with it because it was being counteracted by the 20 years of service. So in the first case, when you do good deeds and you don't see them rewarded, we might put up with that for a day or 2 days or 3 days, but very few people have the strength of character to do good deeds for 20 years with no significant amount of reward, of feeling like they've been validated or seen.
Mm-hmm.
The test there from a spiritual standpoint might be, were you doing it because it was right, or were you doing it for reward, even if that reward was, it was okay to delay the reward. It can be a spiritual test for you to have done that and find out that you could not sustain not getting a reward, that eventually you wanted something back for your effort. And therefore, it wasn't a giving, it was actually a barter. Okay? But there's negativity in there. So the whole time you're giving, this little negativity of where's mine is in operation. If what you get back is negativity from life, what the lecture is suggesting is that you go deeper into your own life and you look very, very carefully and you see where you might be responsible, where there might be some negativity in your life that didn't seem obvious, and it certainly seemed counterbalanced by other aspects of your life. But you see, karmically, you can't do that. Karmically, you can't put three good things and one bad thing on the table and hope that nobody notices the bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Karma is always objective. Spiritual law is impersonal and impartial.
Jan, I want to interject a little current situation that kind of fits into that, and it shows the overall picture. It's not always that easy. I was making a donation, and I asked to for that to be made anonymously.
Mm-hmm.
And then the person who agreed to do that was approached by the leader that was receiving the donation, who wanted to know who gave it so they could send a thank you card. So what do you do in a situation like that? You just say no. I just don't want my name out there, or what?
So if we take that situation, actually you're asking for what to do, but the work is about looking inwards at yourself and asking if you weren't secretly happy that somebody wanted to eliminate the anonymity request. What I'm saying is that the work that might be done in that situation might be to go in and say, was there a secret place of me where I thought I was being a good person to request anonymity, but I was chafing at it? And somebody also chafed at it, so they offered me an out. They offered me an opportunity to very simply and easily remove the, I'm going to call it a gift of anonymity. Okay?
So you call it what was that word? Of anonymity?
Anonymity. Anonymous gift gives you anonymity.
Uh-huh.
Okay, it makes you anonymous. Hope I'm getting
right.
So what I'm saying is that you might have requested that because you felt it was appropriate, and I'm not saying it was a negative thing. But at the moment where somebody says, would you change your mind, and they give you a rational argument for doing so, if your original statement was valid, why would you change it? If their request is reasonable, why would you not consider it? All these things are true. The work is about the secret feelings that only you know about. The work is about the glee you felt when somebody offered to take away anonymity and actually name you, that you might actually have wanted it. So I don't see in your example anything negative or bad or big. And in all honesty, it's not very easy to work with situations that are benign. Okay?
Uh-huh.
So when they're benign, where's the juice? Where do we work? Where's the distorted feeling? So if there isn't a distorted feeling here that you need to figure out, then it's simply a logic argument. Would it help them if they knew the benefactors? You know, what's the pluses, what's the minuses? You make the list on both sides of the page and do what seems appropriate in the moment.
Uh-huh.
But the lectures are focusing on areas of our lives that carry a lot of distortion. That's the distinction. We're not focused on our happy birthday parties. We're not focusing on the things we do well. There's a place where when I teach and when I give sessions, what I try to tell people is that you can do for free. Okay, you don't have to come to a workshop. That's what you do when you sit with your friends. That's what you do with your family. Society is a place where we celebrate the things we do well, where we meet each other and we pat ourselves on the back and we talk about the struggle that we have when there's not really a huge distortion in it. But the spiritual work that Pathwork addresses specifically are the areas where we're a little ashamed to talk about our real motives. So, well, I'm feeling two threads of the discussion here, and sometimes it's perfect because they meet. They haven't met yet, but I'm really expecting them to meet. So one question is about how do we know, and your question is it appropriate to do a specific thing? If I answer your question, it doesn't seem to matter much what you do. I don't hear a lot of juice in a yes answer or a no answer. But you might know that there is some feeling about one answer versus the other. And if that's in conflict or if it's not in congruity with who you think you are, that's a good place to work. So we're not talking about simple decisions. And maybe this is where this meets up. When we say, how do we know where we came from? One of the answers to that question might be, what does it matter? If we were meant to know, we would have given ourselves the memory. There's several places in the lectures, and there's a lot of ways to paraphrase it, but what it comes down to is your life does not lie. Okay? And the extension of that is that you have everything you need in this lifetime to achieve the spiritual task that you assigned yourself. That may include memory, and it may include forgetting. It may include finding a spiritual teacher, and if it does, you will be attracted and egged on to do that. But if your spiritual task, for all everybody else says, would not be helped or accelerated by a spiritual teacher and would be accelerated by being alone, you may find yourself alone. So where one person is in the group with a spiritual teacher and in a community and very, very happy, and the other person is a hermit, the question would be, how did you get there? Were you following your intuition, your eros? Are you sensing into your spiritual task, and that's where it is for the moment? Or did you run away from your spiritual task? You can run away from a spiritual task by involving yourself in a community where certain questions aren't asked. So for all intents and purposes, from the outside, it looks like you're in a spiritual community. But only you know that this community never examines this aspect of human nature. And so you may actually be there to hide. Just as much as someone who becomes a hermit and who looks like he's avoiding human contact, they may be hiding, but they may also be creating an isolation that they need in order to find and examine certain levels of personal feeling and spirituality. So in this place, you as an individual, every person on the planet, is the only one who really, truly knows whether you make the right decision or the wrong decision, whether you are following your eros or running away from it, whether you are willing to look at yourself or whether you are quite conveniently looking someplace else diligently because you kind of know you're not looking where the issue is. So there's no right or wrong answer to your question about what to do unless certain feelings came up when the question was asked of you. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to assume it did and go on. So, cause and effect. With a quote from the lecture is, you set up continuous chains of action and reaction, of which you often lose track. That one of the ways to deliberately avoid your own work is to confuse, to obfuscate, to muddy the water so that you can't see what you're doing. Now, I use a lot of movies to teach with because I find that film, like all art forms, reflects the human experience. And one of the best examples of separating cause and effect was the movie Memento. And in the movie, the man had an injury that caused him to lose short-term memory. So he remembered things from before the accident. But after the accident, he could only remember things for 3 to 5 minutes. And so he developed some compensating tools for this. He developed, he would take Polaroid snapshots of something and write down who that person is and what they meant, a sentence or two. And as the movie progresses, he looks like a person who's trying desperately to find justice and find the truth and all that. But as the movie progresses, it comes down to a moment when he realized that if he wrote a lie on the picture, that 5 minutes later he would not remember it was a lie, and he would rely on it from that point forward. And then he writes the lie on the picture. And the movie is a confusing movie because it does flashbacks throughout the whole film. So you've already seen the results of this. You've seen where he chased the wrong person and made the wrong interpretations because he assumed that he had written down the truth because that was his method, to write down the truth. And all he needed to do was one single time to write down a lie. And the magic of the movie is that when he wrote it down, he knew he wouldn't remember it was a lie. So that's a rather stunning and dramatic example of where you can separate cause and effect to a point where you can't put them back together again from a human perspective. For all intents and purposes, the connection is broken. Once you break the apparent connection between cause and effect, then you can pretend that you're not doing negative things.
Do we do that with our consciousness, or we do it with our unconsciousness?
We do it with our unconsciousness and our consciousness.
How do you do it with consciousness?
Okay, I'm going to do the movie thing again. Mm-hmm. And talk about the picture of Dorian Gray, because it's historical and it's a myth, and you might have heard of it. And that movie was about a man who had a portrait painted and made a wish that the portrait would reflect his negativity and let him be forever young. And magic happens in the movie, and that's what happens. So as he becomes a drunkard and a dilettante and a mean and vicious person, he still stays beautiful and young, and the picture becomes hideous. It's a story, I know, but mm-hmm. It's a way where we can avoid the manifested aspects of our negativity. And I think the reason it is such an all-time classic movie is we recognize that in ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Now, it was conscious at some point, and then what happens is it just, we forget. And it's as if it sinks into the unconscious and we're simply no longer aware of it. So if you make a conscious attempt to disengage cause and effect, and there's no mechanism that brings it back in your face again,
mm-hmm.
for all intents and purposes, it's permanently disconnected as far as your human life is concerned. However, on a spiritual level, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Again, karma is like an elephant. It's got a long memory. Cannot fool karma. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, we'll repeat this phrase. You set up continuous chains of action and reaction of which you often lose track. Now, the unconscious requires the conscious to do things. So when your unconscious does something, it's got to involve your consciousness at some point. Unconscious by itself with no action doesn't do anything. So when people say, if my unconscious did it, how can I be responsible? You can't. What you can be responsible for is noticing the manifested result. And that's why this lecture is so revered. Because basically what it's saying is cause and effect, that if you've got negativity in your life, you've attracted it. If you can find out how you attracted it, you can stop attracting it, cause and effect. Now, it may not make the karma thing go back to zero, but you stop accumulating negative karma.
Yeah.
So as you stop accumulating negative and you go back towards positive, positive can be very attractive and you can whiz into the positive. I think of karma like a credit card. So sometimes it's a savings account, sometimes it's a credit card. So
yeah.
Sometimes you owe and sometimes you're storing up. It's not a static thing. There's no perfection to it.
But you made an interesting comment and that was that if you can find the moment that you were unconscious that caused the separation of cause and effect,
mm-hmm.
that you can't erase the karma, but you can change it from that moment.
Right.
So that's like saying if you can just become conscious.
Mm-hmm. So the work in becoming conscious, you know, part of the work is looking, paying attention.
Yeah, paying attention.
Noticing.
Yeah.
And part of that is that if I have a negative person in my life, instead of saying, that's a problem, that's got to go, this lecture is inviting you to look at it from a different perspective. I invited that person into my life. Ooh, yuck.
Or person, or situation, or event,
mm-hmm.
or...
Mm. Mm-hmm. By creating a situation where negativity could enter. Now, if you don't find that comfortable, change that to the positive. In the areas of your life that go positive, what if they go positive because you attract positive? You send out positive vibes, and positive vibes come to you. If that is true, why would it not be equally true that if there's negativity in your life, you must have invited it? This is not trying to blame anybody or tell anybody they're bad. It's simply saying there's cause and effect. Now, if you go to a place where you say, but I didn't ask for this, this is where I have found the lectures very positive. So I'm going to make an extreme example. If somebody is born with a very, very difficult disease and they can't get over it and they grow up crippled in mind, body, and spirit because of whatever it is, whether that's a hangnail or a missing leg or a skin disease or multiple operations, doesn't really matter because our attitude is what's important. So there are some very happy, handicapped people who simply overcome that. And there are some very normal people who are miserable because their hair color is wrong. It's a matter of attitude, how we approach things. But at some point, humans believe or have believed, it's a common cultural thing in Western Hemisphere, to say, it's not my fault I was born crippled. Now, Pathwork changes this paradigm. And this is critical to understanding the Pathwork lectures. Pathwork says you chose to be born with this disease. You volunteered for it. This particular disease was going to send your life in a direction that was going to help you learn a spiritual lesson that you could learn no better way. You asked for it. The fact that it's a heavy burden and it's hard to carry and you're whinging, okay. It's still working because it was divinely inspired. You dreamed this up when you were in spirit and had a lot more resources and intelligence and foresight than you do as a human being. So some wise part of you decided to get born with being short, being diseased, being handicapped, being blind, being 7 feet tall, some quality that makes life difficult for you. This was a choice. And it was meant to bring you into interaction with certain obstacles. If your attitude to that is positive, even if the results are poor, your attitude will still be, that's okay, we'll just try again. But if your attitude brings you into situations that basically encourage you to think negatively and bitterly, to curse God, to berate your parents for their gene pool, to believe that the doctors did it to you, or society doesn't support. If this is your mindset, you're creating a negative force field around you. And you will attract people who think the same way. So imagine a room full of people who believe it's somebody else's fault. Please understand, I'm not talking about a rational argument to determine what to do and how to deal with it. I'm talking about a blame fest. And if sitting in this pool of blame fest among the colleagues that you attract to you and the friends you attract to you, or even the family you got born to, which may have had a tendency to blame people, and now they've got extra ammunition, number one, you will probably be met with negativity by others. But underneath that, there's something that it's possible for you to learn. So this lecture is talking about where we are responsible for the negativity in our lives. And again, if you say, but it's just negative and there's nothing I can do about it, that's an attitude. You do control your attitude. So one person may think that being in a wheelchair is negative, but another person may not. It's a personal choice. What we think of life. The person who's in a wheelchair who says, that's too bad, and I'm going to go into the Olympics, or I'm going to do something, is going to attract people who also have a let's win, let's figure it out, let's overcome attitude. And the person in the wheelchair who feels put upon and who feels that they might be bad and who feels there's a lot of blame running around and they don't want it to come on them, so they're going to push it onto others, that person is going to attract certain energies throughout their life.
Is some of this not fear-based? Does some of it not come from fear?
Yes. And what the lecture is saying is we can control our fear. We are not slaves to fear.
No.
Fear is one of the things that you want to look at.
Yes.
Fear is one of the things that you want your objective observer to look at so that you can look at the situation from a more impartial point of view. So fear is simply fear. You can be afraid and get over it, take a few deep breaths, and go on, can't you?
Yeah, I see fear as sort of the opposite of love, and that when you were talking before about negativity, just in my own personal sense is that maybe for me I speak only, that negativity in my own self, I sometimes, more or less, can relate it to operating from a place of fearfulness as opposed from a place of acceptance and love.
Okay, I accept that. What the lecture would say in that case is if that is producing a result that you feel is negative.
Yes.
And you want to change.
Yes.
Then you're going to have to look at the habit of fear.
Yeah.
You're going to have to look at where you find fear comforting.
Yeah.
And it can be. When we are fearful, we are consumed with emotion. And that can sometimes muffle details that actually create a lot of anxiety in us. So again, I'm going to exaggerate. This is where a drama queen kind of routine, where somebody gets really upset and throws a really big fit and they may be covering a very small sense of insecurity. But when they go into this drama act, they don't notice the insecurity. They actually feel better. Even though the drama act may lead them into some negative responses, and it may lead them into destructive behavior, what they're really trying to do is get rid of that nagging feeling of anxiety.
Mm.
What this work is about is very slowly and gently and with love, figuring out that there's something else going on.
Mm.
And slowly and gently with love, kind of peeking underneath the table and seeing what might be possible that we haven't noticed before. And what the guide is saying is the evidence is probably within your grasp. And when you start doing daily review, when you start doing self-analysis, when you start, for instance, when you work with somebody, whether you work with a professional or you work with a group or you work with a friend. My daughter gave me the most wonderful gift one time. She said, a friend is a therapist that you don't pay. And you pay friendship back in different ways. But that speaking to a friend was a kind of therapy. It wasn't a waste of time. It wasn't just giddy. That there was an opportunity there to really talk about your heart with somebody who actually cares about you.
Yeah, sure.
And that in that expression, in that exchange, you can find out some things about yourself. You can hear yourself speak. And it's when those words actually hit the air and rebound off another person that you may realize, ooh, that's kind of prejudiced, isn't it? Or, I never realized how selfish that sounded. Or, you know, that sounds a little boastful. I wonder what's going on there.
Yeah, sure.
Pardon?
No, I said sure, that's friends, family, that's, yeah, sure.
So any human being that you interact with has this potential to act as a mirror to you, and you have more ability than you have imagined to find these areas to work on.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a very short break. I have to change a recorder and create silence. So this is the halfway point.
Well, that was a quick hour.